Blog Talk Radio.
From two beautifully scenic and historic locations, the Hudson Valley, New York, and Willow, Alaska, this is The Side Vibe, brought to you by Dog Works Radio. Your hosts are author, journalist, and photographer, the Five Sides mom, Dorothy Wills Raftery, and Dog Works Radio executive producer, canine behaviorist, trainer, and lead musher of Team Aneke, Robert Forto. The Side Vibe is all about the magnificent breed of the Siberian Husky. From training to grooming, and for those who show and breed, from parenting to playing and rescuing huskies in need, whether mushing over snow-covered trails or lounging on tropical shores, even for Hollywood sides on the big silver screen and so very much more. If it's about a Siberian Husky, we'll chat about it here.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, hosting from Willow, Alaska, and on the line, calling in from the state of New York, Dorothy Wills Raftery. Dorothy, how's it going?
It's going well, Robert. I probably sound a little hoarse. I'm just battling a little laryngitis because we've been having quite a New York winter this year. I'm guessing you guys would probably like our winter that we're having up there. How are things up there?
Everything is good. We just got about a foot of snow this week, so everything is great. The trails
Excellent.
Are rocking and rolling. I know that they're having a tough go at it on the Iditarod this year, but it looks like everybody is back on snowy trails, at least on the second half of the race. But over here in these parts, we're ready to go, heading into our second phase of our mushing season. I got a couple of small races coming up in the next few weeks. Looking forward to it.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's good to hear the snows there. I saw through the Anchorage Daily News, they had some photos up there that were just incredible of seeing the dogs go across dry ground. So really happy you guys got some snow and, you know, safe runnings to all the teams, all the dogs and mushers out there. So we're all excitedly watching.
Yes, we are. And, you know, since it is Iditarod week, I thought it was appropriate to talk to one of the up-and-comers in the sport, a junior musher. Of course, it happens to be my daughter who's sitting beside me. But you and I, for at least the year and a half that we've been on the air, we've always done an Iditarod show during the month of March, and we had to do it this year, didn't we?
Yes. Absolutely. And I'm thrilled that Nicole's part of it. So this is, as you said, our special Iditarod edition. And I think it's going to be great to chat with Nicole and, you know, get to know a little bit about the girl behind the number 6 bib this year in the junior Iditarod. And I know, Robert, you must be really proud of her. And it's just really kind of cool to have you on, Nicole. I want to give a little bit of background about Nicole for some of our listeners who may not know. Nicole is 16, and she started mushing in 2001 when she ran her first race at the age of 3. She says, "We are a family-run mushing kennel with 36 dogs. We all mush. We train service dogs for our business, Alaska Dog Works." Nicole ran the 2012 Willow Junior 100 last year, and she finished 11th, and we were all proud of her, too, and watching, and we shared that over on the Five Sides Facebook page as well, because we're always rooting for you guys. And this year, she competed in and finished her first Junior Iditarod. Nicole is a junior at Houston High School in Alaska, where she participates in Softball and Business Professionals of America. She enjoys guitar, piano, training service dogs, and poetry. She owns Wick Sweets Baking Company, which we're definitely going to talk about a little bit later on. After high school, she says she plans on going to college to study marine biology, and she will continue mushing as she has her school breaks. Welcome back again, Nicole. It's really great to have you here.
It's great being here. I'm actually really excited for today.
Yeah, so are we. And really, first up, congratulations on finishing your very first junior Iditarod. I mean, that's fantastic. What an accomplishment.
Thank you so much.
Now, can you tell us, how did you feel at that exact moment when, you know, you crossed your team across the finish line? What was that like? And, you know, what were you thinking?
Well, honestly, the last probably 2 miles of the race took me 2 times longer than it should have. So at the end, I was like, well, I guess I can keep going. We were going slow enough anyways. But I was really hoping that as soon as we crossed and the dogs that we stopped and everything, they were still going to be happy and they weren't going to be tired or hurt or anything. And that's what I got. As soon as we crossed and we got to stop running, they were all wagging tails and happy to see my mom and my dad.
Oh, that's wonderful. And now I'd like to just back up and talk a little bit about qualifying for the Junior Iditarod. Can you tell our listeners the how and when you did this in order, you know, to be in this year's race?
Well, there are no, like, actual qualifying races to run the Junior Iditarod, but I did have to fill out a very, very extensive packet about what dogs I'm running, who says I'm capable of running a race like this, and if it's okay, if I have sponsors, if I'm ready. And I went through months of training, not just on the sled, but also fall training. I had to train up a lot of yearlings and puppies to be able to be on my team this year.
Dorothy, if I can interject real quick, in order to run the Junior Iditarod, she had to have two Iditarod mushers as references, and you know, that's a big deal. I mean, you have to know what you're doing for a musher that's run the Iditarod to put their name on the line to say, yeah, I think this girl can do it.
Yes, absolutely. That's really great. Now, can we ask who the mushers were?
Well, it's my good friend Hugh Neff. We got quite a few dogs from him. I think Nicole ran three or four of those dogs on the race. And David Shear, he's an older school musher. Ran in the Iditarod in the mid-80s to mid-90s.
Oh, that's excellent. Now, before the race, Nicole, you have to be paired with a bib number, which is your start number. Am I correct on that? Okay, now how is that selected? Is it random? Do you have to sign up, say, for your favorite number? Can you just tell us a little bit about that process and also what a start number means?
Actually, the cool thing about my races the past 2 years, I've been bib number 6, so it kind of became my race number, kind of like my dad is usually actually starts out as number 2. But, no, I don't get to choose my bib number. If I did, I'd probably either go with 3 or 5 because those are my lucky numbers. But what they usually do is they put all the numbers, like, on a piece of paper or little tokens that you end up putting on the dog's collars, and you choose them out randomly and blindly. So you don't really get to choose where you start. That way it's always fair.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't happen to get 6 every time.
That's really, I think 6 might become your new lucky number.
Probably.
It is 3, right?
Yeah.
Now, I understand the number 1 is always reserved as an honorary bid number. Now, can you tell us a little bit about why that is and exactly what does that mean?
Usually an honorary bid number, as for Junior Iditarod, it went to the main volunteer for us. It was a way of saying thank you for, you know, helping us put on this race and be able to actually continue to have this race. And it's basically the junior musher's way, or even the musher's in any race's way, to say thanks. You know, if it wasn't for you, it wouldn't be possible to have our race.
Well, that's pretty cool. Now, what do you pack on the sledge for the race?
As light as I possibly can.
Going through my mind is like, you know, everything you need for the dogs and dog food and spare this and spare that and people food. I mean, I'm a foodie, so of course I'm like, oh, how do you pack your food?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is, for me at least, is I usually pack all the dog stuff, a lot of extra gloves, and I don't really ever worry too much about my own food. Because usually, at least for me, when I'm out there, if I'm going to eat, I have to force myself to because I'm too worried or too focused on doing something with the dogs or the race itself. In fact, this year, actually, I had a much better idea of my planning for food than I did last year on Willow 100. And I had these energy protein little gel packs that actually helped me a lot through the race.
Oh, okay. Now, how long was the race?
This year it was 124 miles. It's usually 150, but because of the trail conditions, they had to cut it down this year.
Okay, now, in time-wise, how long does that take, you know, roughly an average to finish?
Roughly for me, it was about 26 hours, but I had a 10-hour layover at Yetna, so it was about 16 hours, which
now,
isn't too bad because usually my dogs are really slow, so.
Now, they're slower. Is it because they're new in training or, because I know that you've mentioned that before too, so why are they slow?
We have a lot of previous ran Iditarod dogs from Hugh Neff lines and Dave Shear lines, actually. So my dogs go at a slower pace because they pace themselves for longer distances rather than a shorter distance.
Okay. So more for like an endurance type thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, along the trail, I mean, do you talk with the dogs? Do you listen to music? I mean, just can you kind of put us in the musher seat with you and just kind of take us out a little bit and tell us, you know, how that is? What do you do?
I do listen to music on the trail. I get really bored if I don't. A big thing for me, though, is one of my leaders, Ty Ty, she hates it if you don't talk to her. And she's developed this really close relationship with me where if I'm not singing on the trail, she gets really upset. So usually I end up singing to my dogs the whole way.
Oh, that's cute. Robert, I bet you wish you could get some video of this, right?
You know, typically Nicole is behind me in training, and I will hear, if I don't have my headphones on, I'll hear somebody singing behind me all the time, and it's quite interesting. We were out on a run last night, and I could see her headlamp bobbing up and down in the darkness, and before I could see her, I could hear her singing voice.
That's just wonderful. I mean, even as a parent, it's got to be awesome. I mean, you know, you have your daughter there. She's happy. She's singing. The dogs are happy and love her singing. So I just think that's really, you know, really pretty cool. Must be just one of those great moments in life, you know.
It is. Now, you know, it's something that we get to do together. And, you know, some people hang around and watch TV. Other people play sports together, you know, go to ball games, whatever. We go out there and stand around on a yardstick-sized runner for endless hours together. So I don't know if it's good or bad, but we like it.
What do you think, Nicole, good or bad?
I think it definitely forms a connection. You know, you spend a lot of time together, so when you actually are at home and you're sitting in front of the TV, that's when you just want your time to yourself. Because usually when you're out there, especially for us, because we train the dogs so close together out on the trail, it's like by the time we get back, we're just ready to go to bed.
Yeah. It's pretty nice, too, because you're forging this relationship outside of, you know, a parent-daughter relationship. You have that as a basis, but, you know, you're there as a team, too, and I think that's really great, you know.
Yeah, a big thing is my dad's, like, always been my coach for everything. Like, when I started playing softball, he actually is the one that taught me, like, the actual ways and the great skills to be a catcher because I'm a catcher. And so he always used to tell me, if you don't catch the ball, you're going to have to walk home. So he's always been that kind of motivational coach for me.
That's excellent. That's really great. Now, how do you know when it's time when you're out on the trail to take a break and rest your dogs? I mean, is that something that you determine, or are there predetermined, you know, rest stops along the way? How does that work?
It's not necessarily a predetermined, like, spot itself. It's more of a timeline thing. Usually I stop and rest the dogs and give them a snack about every 2.5 to 3 hours, just because in the time span it takes to go to the checkpoint, it's usually about 8 hours, so it keeps my sleds light for snacks, plus it gives them enough rest that they're not trying to sleep the whole way, but they are getting a boost of energy still.
And now just a question about, like, when they have their snacks and then they have to run. Is there a time frame? Because, you know, I'm always thinking of, like, with regular, you know, family dogs, they're like, well, you know, you can't feed them and then let them run. You have to give them, you know, some time in between, you know, for the food. So is there anything like that, or is it because of the nature of the type of snacks they can go right back to running?
I believe it's has to do with the size of the snacks too. I mean, if you're out there feeding them a meal, of course they're not going to want to run afterwards, but a lot of the times my dogs like salmon the best. They'll eat it real quick and they'll get right back on moving. But I found out this year actually on Junior Iditarod that with beef snacks they actually wanted to take a little bit longer, So mm-hmm. I had that as an issue, but they still go. They just take a little bit longer to process some types of foods. I think it also depends on the size of the snack, too, and how fast you get it to the dogs and are ready to go.
Nicole, can you mention what size of the salmon snacks they are and how quick you feed these snacks from the time you get off the sled to the time you get back on?
Salmon snacks are usually about a quarter of a pound, so they're not very big and they're not, like, very much for them to even eat. It's just a little simple taste of energy that they get, so they get back excited to ready to run. But a lot of the time, especially this year at Junior Iditarod at the rookie meeting, we had an Iditarod musher talking about how saving time on snacks and, oh, it'll only take you about 30 seconds. Well, for me, I feel like 30 seconds isn't long enough for my dogs to rest. I'm not a musher who's really concerned about time, so I like to go give my dogs a snack, give them a little pat, check their feet and their booties, even if it takes me longer than 30 seconds. For me, I'd say probably about a minute or so, just that way I can still have that connection with the dogs, make sure they know that I'm still here and that they're not just running for no purpose.
Mm. Wow, that's really interesting. A minute and a half, huh? I'm thinking it'll probably take me that long to get off the sled. So to me, it's just, that's amazing, you know, the speed at which these things are done. Now, along the way, how many checkpoints are there along the trail, and what kinds of things happen, you know, when you pull in for them?
For a Junior Iditarod, there's actually only one checkpoint. It's at Yetna Station. And I've been there before on training runs with my dad. It's a really nice place. They run it really well. They give you hay and all that sorts of stuff. But at Junior Iditarod, it was really nice because I pulled in and everyone was still there to meet me, even though I was like 2 hours behind the last musher. So.
Oh, that's nice, too, for the support, and they're out there. And I'm sure they all get very excited, too, you know, having I would be thrilled.
yeah.
Now, I just want to let everyone know you're listening to the Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio. And on today's special Iditarod edition, we're chatting with Team Ineke 16-year-old musher Nicole Fordo, who just completed her first junior Iditarod. You can follow Nicole as well as her parents, mushers Robert and Michelle, on the family's Team Ineke Facebook page, their website, teamineke.com, and at Team Ineke on Twitter. Nicole, you're a busy young lady, you know, being, of course, a junior in high school, having after-school activities, training the dogs, and you have your Wick Sweets baking company. But with all the business of being a teenager, how do you actually find the time to train for a race?
I have no life. actually, a big thing is I have a lot of supportive friends who understand that during mushing season, especially during training and when it's getting close to racing, that I can't hang out. That, and all my teachers understand it too. A lot of the times, because season usually starts right at second semester, like race season starts, and so I get even busier. So a lot of the times my teachers will actually give me a little bit more time to finish things. That way I'm still ahead because I do maintain very good grades and while working in the business and helping train the dogs and racing.
Wow, that's really great. Now, in Alaska, sled dog racing is basically a state sport. It's quite extraordinary. So being a musher, I was going to ask you about what's it like being in school for you. You know, I mean, do your classmates think it's pretty cool? Is it kind of like an everyday thing for them? Do any of them mush? Do you take them for rides? I mean, how take us into school with you and with what you do and just kind of, you know, let's talk about that for a little bit.
I do get a lot of advice about dogs and, like, how to train my dog. Actually, one of my friends, Mariah, she actually asked me to help her cut her dog's nails because I have to cut sled dog nails, and that's really hard to do. But this year especially, I got a huge support system from my school. When I came back the weekend after the race, everyone literally just, I walked in and everyone was like, good job, Nicole, congratulations. Who cares if you finished last? You still did great.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually was a huge thing for me because even though I knew I did great for even finishing last and finishing in general, it was still nice to see that I had people that I didn't even really know supported my whole mushing career, supporting me, actually.
That's really great. Now, are there any other teens that mush in your school, or are you the girl?
I'm pretty sure I'm the only one that actually is a musher. I know there are a few people who have, like, done the tour rides and all that kind of stuff, but nowhere near what I do and how I take care of the dogs, not only training them, but I feed them and I brush them. I take care of their nails. I take care of every aspect of the dog's life.
Wow. Now, have you ever brought any of the dogs into school? You know, sometimes, you know, some of the schools have programs where, you know, they talk about them. You know, I know your dad's planning a tour to do almost that very same thing. Have you ever done anything like that?
Actually, I almost did. I had I take an ecology class because I want to be a marine biologist, and we were doing a project based on food chains around our house and where we live, and I got to include my sled dogs because they eat beaver meat and stuff like that, and salmon, and so they got included in my food chain, and I actually almost was going to bring in either Denali or Bodhi, one of the dogs. So it actually was pretty cool that they were open to it, but it didn't happen. But it's okay.
Now, getting back to the race, how many dogs did you run on your team, and how did you select them?
I ran 10 dogs. I was allowed to have 12 at the vet check. The biggest thing for me was dogs that can camp, especially since it was a 10-hour layover, and dealing with a chewer and dogs that bark the whole time for 10 hours isn't fun for me or the other dogs or the other mushers. So that was a huge factor. Another thing for me was giving dogs that may not have made it to the big leagues for my dad's races because he runs so far, but giving them a chance still to be in a race and have that experience, even though they couldn't necessarily make it the 200 miles, but they were right at that 150 point.
Now, were Bodhi or Reagan, who are featured in your parents' illustrated book, Team Ineke, A Musher's Dream, were they on your team?
Bodhi was on my team this year. Last year, for Willow 100, I ran Reagan and Bodhi, but a huge issue I had was Reagan decided she didn't want to run for me anymore about 5 miles before the stop, and so she then convinced Bodhi to not run for me. So this year I decided I didn't want to deal with her because she doesn't really like running for me. She's a daddy's girl. But Bodhi actually did really great. He kept the team going the whole time.
So Reagan's a daddy's girl there, Robert?
Yes, she is. And, you know, Bodhi, I know we talk a lot about Bodhi and Reagan here on the show. Just recently after Nicole came back from the Junior Iditarod, Bodhi has now stepped up and is now becoming a lead dog. He's been leading on my team for about 2 weeks now, so I think he's really stepped into his genes, so to speak. He's now becoming a lead dog.
That's wonderful. And now both Bodhi and Reagan are Siberian Huskies, right?
Yes.
And how many on your team were Siberian and how many were Alaskan?
Just one. Just Bodhi.
Just Bodhi?
Just Bodhi.
Now, Nicole.
He does have enough power, just like the Alaskan, so it doesn't really matter that he's a Siberian. He's just fluffier.
A little perspective about that, Dorothy, if we could. I think that there are only four, maybe five Siberian Husky Iditarod teams, so Alaskans, by and large, make up the Iditarod pool. It's pretty rare and pretty exceptional for a team of Siberians to be able to make it, at least these days, and be competitive on the Iditarod or some of the bigger races.
Now, why is that, Robert? Is it because of the endurance or what's bred into Alaskans? Or, you know, why is there a difference?
Well, the Alaskan Husky has been bred to run as a sled dog, whereas the Siberian Husky, its background is in mushing, but it's, you know, obviously been bred for other things, companionship and showmanship and everything else, whereas the Alaskans were born and bred specifically to be sled dogs. Now, of course, there's lots of similarities in both. there's still quite a bit of the Siberian look and the husky genetics and the way that they act. It's just not that purebred focus that you see in a purebred Siberian as there is in Alaskan.
Okay, good. That's great. Thank you for clarifying that. You know, you often wonder, and sometimes I picture, you know, I know we've talked about the Siberian way, and, you know, I have a few that I could just see them telling me they were done running, and we'd be done.
Of course, yes.
Now, Nicole, can you walk us through a typical day for you, you know, from the time, say, you get up to the time you actually go to sleep, and let's pick a day during race season so we can see how you do it.
Do you want a day close to a race or just training in general?
Let's do training in general.
Well, I wake up at about 6 o'clock in the morning and I get ready for school. I help my mom take care of the Camp Works dogs for Alaska Dog Works. I take care of my dog, Kane, my German Shepherd. And then my mom and I get in the car and she drives me to school in the morning. I go to school. I have 7 periods. Usually we're on block schedule, so I don't have all 7 periods a day. I usually have 5. And then I get home around 3:30, and I feed the house dogs again. And then depending on whether my dad plans on running early or late, I usually feed after I feed the house dogs. I feed the kennel dogs. I get his sled ready and my sled ready, all the harnesses, all the booties, all of that ready. And then I start harnessing the dogs when he says he's about 20 minutes away from the house. And then he comes down and I hook up his team and then I hook up my team and then I go run 20 to 25 miles each evening. And then we come back and usually we give the dogs a snack and we put them back on their poles and we take Bodie and Reagan back up to the house. And then I go to bed again the next day.
That's quite a schedule. It really is. And so commendable. And, Robert, I think that's wonderful. I'm listening as a parent as well and hearing how, you know, she's getting your sled and your dogs ready. And that's going to be pretty cool to know that your daughter's doing this.
It is. You know, we do that mainly so we're as efficient as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm heading home from work, we often text each other, where are you at, so we can get going. Because, you know, it takes a considerable amount of time to do each step. So she's a big help in that. You know, not only is she a musher, but she's a handler for the team as well. And just to give folks a little bit of perspective, when we say that we're running 25 miles, which is a typical loop around our home trails here that we run right off of the back of the house, that takes about 3 to 3.5 hours to do that. Then, you know, to hook up is about 45 minutes and then run 3 to 3.5 hours and then you unhook, which is another half hour or so after you feed snacks. And then by the time we're sitting down, often we're eating dinner at 9 or 9:30, maybe 10 o'clock at night. And then, of course, everything that comes with getting ready to retire for the evening, whether we're, you know, doing homework or watching television or doing whatever, taking showers, it makes for a long day. As she said, she gets up at 6 o'clock, and typically we're done, I don't know, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the height of race season.
Wow, that's quite a day. I mean, that's quite a day for anyone, but, you know, again, too, I mean, she's a student, she has excellent grades. I think that's extremely commendable. And there's a great team spirit going on here, too. You know, I know you guys are all family, but, you know, it's also just this wonderful team ethic, too, that, you know, that everybody's learning and working together. And that's also the nature of, you know, when you're running sled dogs. I mean, you are a team with them. So, you know, across the board, it's just really a lot of great life lessons there, I think. And just really, you need to be commended, Nicole, because it's, you know, I remember being a teenager, and I was an equestrian, so my day started early as well in a barn with horses. So, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, to do that and still pull off, you know, school and grades and that. So I know there's got to be a real love and passion there for it. What do you find to be the most rewarding thing about being a musher, Nicole?
For me, all racing aside, all training aside, all the, like, bonding it's created between me and my parents, honestly, it's the dogs themselves. Like, I couldn't ask for different dogs, better dogs, faster dogs. like, to me, that doesn't really matter. Every dog we have, because 36 dogs is hard enough to remember all their names, let alone have a relationship with. I actually have that bond with every single one of them, whether they're bees or older dogs, or they're big or small or fast, slow, hard pullers or not hard pullers. I have that bond that no matter what time of day it is, no matter how bad of a mood I am in or how bad of a mood they're in, they're always there to smile when they see me. And a prime example of that whole bond thing is one of our dogs, Ragnar. He looks like the scariest dog in the world, but he's actually a huge teddy bear. And on accident one day, I talked to him and said hi to him in a British accent, and he just absolutely goes crazy for it.
Oh, you're kidding. That's so cute. Oh. Now, the flip of that is, what do you find the most difficult, if anything?
Probably the week before a race. It's usually when the household gets the most hectic and me and my dad butt heads the most, because we have different ways of wanting to do the race, and how sometimes he wants to coach and be there for me so badly, but when it comes down to it, sometimes he can't be there out there on the trail for me, so we end up butting heads over situations, and it just creates a stress ball just before the race, which is never fun.
Now, mushing is obviously in your blood, and where did you originally learn it from? I'm guessing from your dad, your mom and your dad?
Actually, it was my dad. My first race when I was 3, I actually did with my most favorite dog in the whole wide world, Zorro. He's actually a Red Siberian. And we finished, and I won a bag of dog food, and I have this picture of me with bright red cheeks and bright red ears because it was so cold with my dad, and I think that's when our whole relationship with the dogs and each other kind of started.
Oh, that's so sweet. You have to post that picture. I would love to share that with our listeners. I think that would be very precious.
I'll have him do that.
Yeah, definitely, Robert.
We'll do,
now,
for sure.
Now, I imagine, Robert, you and Michelle are extremely proud, of her, and I know that you're right there cheering her on. And what's it like to watch her when she's out there on the trails and competing?
Well, that's a loaded question, Dorothy. We on mushing, as a fan, you're watching a tracker on a computer screen. And if anybody knows anything about spot trackers, it's a little device that the mushers carry along on the trail, and it's satellite-based, so it pings about every 5 minutes of the location of where the mushers are. So a typical mushing fan will sit there and refresh on their computer screens as often as they can, almost to the point of madness. And when we're doing that, we're seeing if she's making it down the trail. You can see the speed and if she's stopped and if she's, with the pack of other mushers and how she's getting along and so on and so forth. So the time on the trail for any mushing fan is maddening, especially for parents, because you're kind of helpless out there. There she is, 60 or 70 miles out into the Alaska wilderness. You never know what's going to happen. But, you're just sitting there figuring out, okay, well, she knows what she's doing, she'll be okay, and, we have faith in that she will. But, of course, the obvious side of being a parent is you're just so elated that she's out there doing what she's doing and she's enjoying it. And then, of course, when she comes in, it's that reunion. You just feel so alive that your kid has accomplished something that so few have. With the Junior Iditarod, they've been running that race for 37 years. And Nicole happens to be musher number 482. So only 482 people in the world have had the honor of entering and finishing the Junior Iditarod. And I think that's a special thing, not only as a parent, but just as a fan, that your kid has done something that few have.
Oh, that's amazing. That's wonderful. It actually gives me the goosebumps, you know, because I think of it as a parent, you know, what you're saying and just putting myself in that position. And, Nicole, that's amazing. It really is. That's wonderful. Now, Robert, how did you do you help her prepare for a race?
Well, I think most of the way that we learn, it's almost through osmosis. Since she and I train so close together, almost all of our runs we do together. So she mimics what I do, and I'll do a little bit what she does. And, you know, there's a lot of give and take when you're training a team of sled dogs. And, you know, with the ability to pick and choose the dogs that we want to run on our teams, we're able to pick our favorites. As Nicole mentioned a little while ago, we have a dog named Ty Ty. Excellent leader for Nicole. She is definitely one of Nicole's girls, as you mentioned, the daddy's girl with Reagan. That dog will pretty much pull her anywhere, but with me, I get so frustrated with her because she'll pull, I don't know, 15 or 20 miles, and then she'll act like she has a sore paw. So I'll pull her out a lead and put her back in the team, and she's running like she's never ran before. So it's just that aggravation that you sometimes have. And with Reagan, you know, we talk a lot about Bodie and Reagan here on this show. You know, Reagan she's a little princess. She doesn't want to work for anybody except for me. And Nicole will often say, I don't want to run Reagan. She quits on me every single time. And just last night, Reagan was on my team. We did a 30-mile run, and her tug line was taunt the entire 4 hours. So, you know, it's just that ability to give and take on how we teach each other. But, you know, more than anything, and I want Nicole to mention this because we have plenty of time, on what happens at a camping trip. You know, a lot of people, when they think of mushing, oh, yeah, you guys are going camping. And, you know, most people think of camping, you're setting up a tent and a fire and roasting
nice
marshmallows.
Nice campfire, yeah.
Yeah, you know, doing, you know, sitting back and enjoying life. But it's not that way. So if you don't mind, Dorothy, Nicole, can you kind of run down what a camping trip is, whether it's at a checkpoint or just a camping trip in general with a team of sled dogs?
Actually, before I do, you failed to mention the fact that while my race was going on, you got so upset that you had to go out and run the dogs.
That's right. You know, I did that on the day she was out on that junior. Iditarod is a weekend race, so they leave on Saturday morning, and as Nicole mentioned, there's a 10-hour layover. She got there, I don't know, maybe
about
7 o'clock at night, and then, of course, she left at 4 o'clock in the morning. But I was so frustrated with punching that refresh button on my I was using my iPad. I hooked up a team of 12 dogs and went out for a 40-mile run myself. And then when I remember thinking right when I was pulling into the yard, okay, well, it took me X hours. I don't remember how long it took me. I should be able to go in right now and check the tracker, and she should have ran the same 40 miles in the same amount of time. And she was going a little slower than I was, but that's not a big deal. But that was just my way of dealing with the madness of following a musher on the spot tracker. It's just absolutely crazy.
Oh, I think that's pretty funny. And, you know, actually, now that you say that, you had posted, I think, over on your Team Ineke Facebook page that you were taking the dogs out for a little run. And I remember thinking, isn't Nicole running today?
Yes.
So it's funny to actually get the story behind it, you know, but that's funny. I could see just, you know, poking away there. It would, I think, drive most of us insane like that. So Nicole, take us camping.
Well, for me this year, actually on Junior Iditarod, my dad and I came up with a different idea to pre-make, their first meal at the checkpoint before we left from the race. So the meat was already melted and the kibble was already soaked and it was with water already in my sled. And it didn't really add any extra weight. My dogs didn't act like it was bothering them or anything. So it was fine the whole way. It actually helped me be able to get more rest at the checkpoint than I did last year for Willow 100. Because as soon as I got to Yetna, I got all my stuff unloaded. I got their tug lines off, their booties off, the straw laid out. I have a few dogs that get sore feet, so I went and I took care of their feet, And I got all their bowls out, I got my cooker out, and I started getting water ready for their second feeding while I fed them their first. That way they didn't have to wait as long. That way they could get their food in them and rest and have all those nutrients waiting for them in their stomach when they had to start going 10 hours later.
Now, how long of a process does this take for you to do?
Usually melt the whole process of melting the water, waiting for the meat to defrost is about 2 hours to 2.5 hours. That's why it was such a good idea for us to just pre-melt the meat and the kibble and have it all ready to go. That way my dogs weren't waiting another 2.5 hours just to get food in them.
Wow,
and
that's amazing.
And then you do it all in reverse right before you go. So a typical scenario at a checkpoint, and Junior Iditarod is a longer time at a checkpoint than any other race, of course. There's kids as young as 14 running that, so they want to give them time for ample rest. Typically, the musher, him or herself, isn't resting at all. They might get an hour, maybe hour and a half on a very lucky day to be able to rest themselves. It's typically all dog care at this camp. You want to make sure that the dogs are taken care of when you get there, and then you get them to be able to rest as quickly as possible, and they will rest on a pad of straw in the snow, and they're all still out in their line, lined out as if they're ready to go. So we put out a sachet of straw, you know, a clump of straw. I don't know exactly what it's called. And then they will rest as quickly as possible, and then you do everything in reverse on the way. So almost always the human part of the team gets very little rest. Isn't that right, Nicole?
Actually, this year I was very proud of myself and my dogs included, because last year on Willow 100, I was right next to a team that their wheel dogs were popping the line and barking the entire time, nearly chewed through an entire gang line and ripped up a whole bunch of tugs. I ended up actually giving that girl some extra tugs because I had longer ones. But this year it was really nice. The team that was in front of me was already bedded down when I arrived, and none of the dogs were barking, none of them were chewing, my team and other teams included. So it was really nice, actually, this year, instead of getting 25 minutes of sleep, I actually got to sleep for 2 hours, actually. And I know you bed down with Bodhi. I actually bedded down with Trapper and Shifter, my wheel dogs, who you would think wouldn't let me do that, but they did. They actually both slept on either side of me and kept me warm, and so I got to sleep with them. It was actually really cool.
Oh, that's amazing. So that is a typical camping. It's a lot of work, and like you said, it's all about the dogs. I know a lot of people always ask, you know, how are the dogs cared for out on the trails? And I have to say, from everything I've seen and heard and Robert talking with you, I mean, they get excellent care. I mean, the dogs are number one. I just want to let any listeners who are tuning in that you are listening to The Side Vibe on Dog Works Radio. And on today's special Iditarod edition, we are chatting with Team Aneke's 16-year-old musher, Nicole Fordo, who just completed her first junior Iditarod. You can follow Nicole as well as her parents, mushers Robert and Michelle, on the family's Team Aneke Facebook page, their website, teamaneke.com, and at Team Aneke on Twitter. Now, Nicole, you know, for anyone who's listening and thinking about, like, they might want to, you know, start, you know, do some dog sledding, or, you know, any advice for them, or, you know, any thoughts that you would share with them if they were thinking about doing this?
Probably the biggest piece of advice is just think about the amount of poop you're going to have to be picking up, because granted, yeah, you may only have 10 dogs, but most dogs poop 2 or 3 times after they eat, and it adds up. After a while, it gets to be a lot of poop.
But, now, that is a good point. It's a little less glamorous side of it, right?
A big thing for me, actually, when I first started out, when I first started doing the training before I even decided to do a race, was tie-tie, actually, is the whole reason I actually learned this, was because I got forced into having to do her training. And she was the shyest dog we had, wouldn't come to me, wouldn't come to my mom or my brother or my dad. And so every day after I fed for about 3 months, I would go and I would just sit on her house and talk to her for 2 or 3 hours, and just finally, eventually, she just started coming closer and closer to me till finally she would sit on her house with me, and now she actually will jump on her house and paw at me when she actually wants to be touched, and that's why I have such a close relationship with her, closer than my dad or my mom do, because I spent so much time with her getting her to trust me. For any musher, becoming an adult musher, a junior musher, just wanting to see how it is, how, if it's fun or not, if it's something they're interested in, a huge, huge thing, the most important thing to me is you have to have a bond with your dogs. It doesn't matter if they're the happiest dogs in the world, like Ragnar is, or the shyest, like Tai Tai. You just, no matter what, you want to be able to have that bond. That way, when you're 60 miles out on a trail and nowhere near any civilization, you can have that trust that your dogs are going to be the thing that make or break you out there on the trail, that save you if something bad happens.
Excellent advice. Now, Nicole, in addition to the mushing, you do train service dogs at your parents' Alaska Dog Works. Can you tell us a little bit about this, and what is it about, you know, service dogs that interests you?
Actually, when we still lived in Colorado and I was about 10, I met this girl, Riley. She has Down syndrome, and she's in a wheelchair, and I helped my mom start out her training for a Labrador, and that little girl just completely took my heart when I first met her. She always tried to talk to me and wave at me, even though it was really hard for her to, and it actually created my bond, I guess you could say, with helping my mom train the service dogs, because I could see how much that little girl really needed that service dog and how much it just lit up her whole world to have the dog.
Wow. Now, in addition to your work with the dogs, you also own your own business, the Wick Sweets Baking Company, which sounds delicious. So can you tell us about this? I mean, you know, what's your role in the business? What do you bake? Do you cater? Are you in the restaurant? You know, is it in restaurant and stores? Do you ship to the Hudson Valley in New York?
Actually, to clarify, it's actually Wicked Sweets. The junior Iditarod actually did a mistype, and we never got to correcting it, and I'm surprised my dad actually didn't correct it when he was talking to you about it, but it is Wicked Sweets Bakery. The whole idea actually came to me because of school.
So it's Wicked with a D?
Yeah.
Okay, like the play, Wicked. Oh, that's really cute. I like it. Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, a huge thing, I was in a business class at my freshman year, and we had to create our own business. It was our final. And I love baking and cooking. It's something that is a de-stress for me. It's something that I do for fun. I love making homemade stuff. I'm not a box cake kind of person. So I kind of tied in the fact that I love to bake with the fact that I have a huge horror movie obsession. I love horror movies and scary movies and thrillers and all of that. And so the whole name Wicked Sweets kind of came to be, and the idea was that I would incorporate my favorite scary movies into a cupcake or a cookie or anything like that.
Oh, that's a clever idea. That's great. So now, do you sell these anywhere? Do you just have them for fun and just share them with all your very lucky friends?
Actually, this summer, we're looking at trying to get me set up at the marketplace to actually sell my cupcakes and stuff so I can make profit, and that way I can also help save me for college.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, lots of luck to you, and I definitely love it. Wicked Sweet, that's awesome. Now, your college plans include studying marine biology, you said earlier. What sparked your interest in this field, and where do you hope to be one day?
I'm actually hoping to do a double major at the University of Hawaii. I want to get my master's in marine biology and a bachelor's in elementary education. Just because I love little kids, but usually when they hit that puberty stage and they're not really sure how to be mature and they're immature still, is where I just I stopped being able to deal with kids, and so elementary school teaching was a great idea for me. Plus, especially if I decide to come back up to Alaska, a huge thing up here is teaching, and teaching in the villages, and actually helping kids who really, you know, don't really get an education as well as they could, help them, you know, get to their college dream if they want to go to University of Hawaii. I mean, it's a pretty esteemed school, and it's hard to get to, and a lot of kids, especially up here, even at my high school, and we're not a rural village high school, a lot of kids don't think they can make it out of Alaska to go to a lower 48 school. And so a big thing for me was, if I do go into teaching full-time, not just marine biology, is that I want to be that example for kids who want to have a dream outside of Alaska.
That's wonderful. I was going to say, you're trading the snows of Alaska for the sands and sun of Hawaii. I mean, that's...
I know. A lot of people actually make fun of me and say I'm going to have to sand mush.
Oh. Well, if there's a way of doing it, I am confident you will figure that one out.
Yeah,
Now, getting back to the snow business, what is up next for you, Nicole? Any other races this year? Any plans on entering the Junior Iditarod for 2015?
This year, actually, coming up next weekend, I believe, my dad is running the Goose Bay 150, and I will be his handler for that. And actually, my mom recently, just today, actually, decided she's going to run a race. And I'm actually pretty excited to be able to handle for her for that, because it'll be her first race in a long time. And so I'm actually really proud of her. And she was talking to me about who she should run and who would be a good dog to run and if a puppy can run with another dog. And it was actually a really cool experience that she was asking me for advice, and I'm her daughter.
Oh, that is cool. Yeah. Now, do you think you'll do the Junior Iditarod next year?
With how much fun I actually had this year running, I do plan on running the Junior Iditarod next year. It'll be my last year being able to do junior races, because I'll be 17, and that's the age limit, and then I'll be going off to college, so I'm actually really excited. I hope also next year that I can watch my dad get to the finish line of all of his qualifiers, so that way my freshman year of college, I can watch him cross the start line of the Iditarod.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, it's just it's just amazing. It sounds exciting. I mean, you know, we'll definitely be watching the different things that, you know, you've got planned. You know, you're an amazing role model for the youth. I really have to commend you, and you know, just your goals and everything for wanting, you know, to come back and, you know, to your own, you know, state and continue teaching and helping others. I mean, you really need to be commended, and, you know, I'm proud of you, and, you know, and I'm not even family.
Thank you so much. That actually means a lot to me.
Now, Nicole, before we sign off, if you had one day to spend it exactly as you wished, no chores, no schoolwork, what would you do and where would you be?
Hopefully I'd be traveling, because it's something I would love to do. But in all reality, I mean, it would be the greatest thing to be able to actually be on an ocean line or a coastline or in the middle of the ocean itself and see whales, because I actually, for marine biology, I want to go into mammalology. I want to study the migration of whales and sharks and all the marine mammals out there. And a secret kind of dream of mine is actually I want to do cave diving, the underwater caves, and actually experience the whole transparent animal thing. So probably if I could spend any day doing whatever I want, I'd probably do that.
Wow, that's exciting. Robert, what do you think listening to this?
It's definitely inspirational for sure. You know, Nicole not only is a tough little musher, but she has her head on straight. She's doing well in school, and, you know, that's all on her. We don't really force a whole lot on her in terms of activities, or you need to do this or you need to do that. She's a pretty much an independent thinker and is allowed to do what she wants to do. And, you know, that's how people become successful, is they have the ability to grow. And I think that mushing does that, because you have to be on your toes all the time and make decisions, but it also will allow you to learn from your mistakes. And I think that's important not only for a 16-year-old young lady or, you know, a 43-year-old, almost middle-aged man as myself.
Oh, it's wonderful. Nicole, it's been such a pleasure having you on. And like I said, you're a very impressive and talented young lady. And I'm really excited about seeing, you know, what's in store. And Robert, you have to keep us all updated so we can share that with our listeners. And, you know, I just wish you all the luck with everything. And, you know, as I said before, you're a great role model for teenagers. And Robert, I know you and Michelle are extremely proud of her. And thank you so much for, you know, sharing everything with us on our special Iditarod edition.
Oh, thank you. Actually, if I could mention one last thing, on Junior Iditarod, one up from Wheel, he's actually basically a wheel dog. His name is Aussie. We got him from Hugh Neff this summer, actually, and he ended up being the entire reason I even finished the race, because I had leaders that just didn't want to lead when we got on the river and didn't want to do it, kept stopping and smelling the ground and going in little zigzags on the trail, on the river. And finally I said enough was enough, and I put Aussie up, and he pulled straight the rest of the way, and he actually ended up pulling the rest of the way of the entire race. And
wow.
He pulled all the way to the finish, and he had only led a few times before that. And he definitely was, like, fourth string leader for me. And he got me to the finish. And then last weekend when we went to the Iditarod start, I actually found out that Hugh Neff wanted Aussie back. And I was like, well, no, you can't have him back because he finished a race for me, so.
And,
I know, maybe.
A little bit of backstory about Hugh Neff, if people, you know, obviously they hear that name here on the show. But he is a UConn Quest champion. He won in 2012 and a top 10 Iditarod competitor just about every year. I think he's running in eighth place right now in Iditarod. So he's one of the top mushers in the world. And, when he comes up and congratulates your daughter, it really means a lot. And what did he say to you, Nicole, at Iditarod this year?
He actually shook my hand and said, congratulations, I'm really proud of you, which is actually something that's really huge coming from an esteemed musher like Hugh Neff. Like, I'm obligated to get I'm proud of you from my parents and my friends. Like, those mm-hmm. are the kinds of people that are always just going to be proud of you. But for someone who only knows me through my dad and through pictures and only a few other times of meeting me, to say, you did great, even though you finished last, I'm still proud of you. Other than that, he asked me for Aussie back.
Well, that is huge coming. It really is. And, you know, it's really interesting. And I know we have to wrap it up, but I have to ask you, what is it like crossing the river?
Yetna, I think, is actually a river really fun to run because, yeah, it gets pretty cold because of the wind and everything, but it's much better than having to run hills or spend hours in a swamp. It actually is a great test to see if your leaders do run straight or if they're just running straight because it's a narrow trail.
It's about a mile and a half wide, so it's like running down the Mississippi. It's a very large river, and she spent out of the 150 miles, I think, what, 90 miles or so was it, running down the river?
Yeah.
So it was a long time. And if we can, Dorothy, I know we just have a little bit, but I think the listeners will really get a kick out of crossing the proverbial Mississippi on your trail. Tell us about that. What was it like crossing that open water with a team of dogs, in 15 or 20 degree temperatures?
Well, on the way up to Yetna Station, there was no open water. I crossed over a lot of creeks and the river, of course. Well, on my way back, it was just now getting light outside, and I see this group of snow machines stopping me, and my dogs were already heading down the hill, so I braked real quick, and he said, there's open water you have two options. You can ride down and hope your dogs cross the water, or you can run down there and pull them through and I'll ride your sled. And I said, well, I'm not really sure which one's going to be both. I guess I'll start out on my sled. And so I unhooked my brakes and Aussie plunged through the water, and about two or three sets of dogs in, Aussie quickly realized he was in chest-deep water and just stopped in the middle of the creek, so I had to run down there and pull him all the way through because he was just standing in it. And I got soaked up to just about above my knees in soaking or freezing cold water, and I pulled them the rest of the way through. The snow machiner on the other side said, are you good? Good job. I said, yeah, thanks. I rode about 10 minutes down the trail and started shivering, and I stopped. I had no boot liners in my sled. I just had a change of socks. And so I wrung out my boot liners. I changed my socks and rode on. I ended up finishing the race about 4 or 5 hours later, and I ended up getting first-degree frostbite on my feet.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's incredible. I mean, because, you know, you think about, well, what if you get wet? I mean, I'm thinking of that as you're telling me you're crossing this water. I mean, Robert, I mean, that's, you're something else getting through that like that. But, I mean, that had to be freezing cold.
I think I felt more bad for the fact that my dogs were in chest-deep water than for me. I mean, I can deal with my feet being cold. I quickly just forgot about it because I lost feeling. But the whole way, about, an hour or two, the whole way, the dogs were just shaking, trying to get all the water off of themselves. And Spencer, actually, the dog that has really tender feet who has to constantly wear booties, I kept having to change his booties because they just kept freezing because he was so wet.
He was so wet. And they can run when they're wet like that. I imagine you just, they got to go. You just have to keep going.
Yeah. They're just going to be a little bit colder than normal.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. That's something I think a lot of people don't even, you know, we see pictures and you kind of, you know, of course get the idea of the Alaskan terrain, but I think you just don't actually, you know, I don't even think about these things. It's like quite a run that you have to go through, and you have to be prepared, and you have to know, like, you have to think ahead, like making these decisions. Are you going to run them through? Or are you going to stay on your sled or pull them? And those are all decisions that you have to make so quick out there on the trail, and it's beyond imagination. But that's quite an incredible story.
Yeah, it actually really does show that mushing actually does really make you an independent thinker, because for me, I've never had to go through open water. In the 2 years that I've been training in Alaska with my dad, I've never experienced actually having to go through it. Like, I've gone around it, I've gone next to it, but I've never had to go dead center through open water. So it really was, well, I can either sit here and wait and not go across, or I can just get across and figure it out later. And the first option wasn't really an option at all. I mean, I had to finish the race. That was my goal. And I'm actually very proud of Aussie for dragging the dogs halfway through and then just realizing he was in water.
Wow, that's amazing. And like you said, you know, these things do really give you these basis for life lessons. So, you know, yes, this is a dog race, this is mushing and working as a team with your dogs, but you take these lessons out in the world, like, to make these quick decisions no matter what you're faced with, you know. So it is actually an excellent training for life as well, right, Robert?
Exactly. Couldn't have said it better myself.
Wow.
I actually didn't realize that mushing could be a life lesson till Junior Iditarod, when I had to make quick decisions on my own, because, like I said, the whole race I was dealing with leaders that just didn't want to lead, and I had to deal with open water quick on a dime. And it was just out there, like, I explained to my dad before my race, there's nothing he can do to help me while I'm out there, so sometimes you just have to back off and let me be my own coach to learn on my own. And that's what happened. A big thing that really touched me when I came back is my dad actually said, "You're an esteemed musher now." And
aww.
So that was big for me. Now you can't tell me what to do all the time.
That's going to come back on you, Robert.
I know it is. I'll hear about it when she's at the altar or somewhere, I'm sure.
Yep. It's going to be worked right into the, you know, the toast, everything.
Yes, exactly. Well, Dorothy, we're just about out of time. Actually, we've been recording for about 15 minutes. I know we're recording this late in the evening for you. It's almost 10 o'clock at night your time. So thanks a lot for making time for us tonight. And, you know, hopefully we shared some stories for your listeners and, you know, they got a little bit of firsthand knowledge on what it's like to not only be a junior musher on the Junior Iditarod, but just all the experience that goes on in running a team of dogs. You know, it's our life. We do it every day. We wake up and go to bed thinking about the dogs. And, you know, a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, think the same about their house pets. You know, to us, we have 36 of our best friends out there. And as Nicole mentioned, I always want to call her Michelle. As Nicole mentioned, we have that bond with every one of them. And I think that's what makes it so special. Not only is it a family business, but it's also being able to spend all that time out there with 36 furry friends. That's an awesome opportunity that not a lot of people get to experience. And I think it's a great way to live through life, is to be able to do what you want to do and try to do it the best you can.
Absolutely. And you know, it's always great talking to you guys. I'm really so thrilled to have this opportunity to talk to, you know, Nicole and, you know, you, Robert, outside of our, you know, our regular shows. It's a lot of fun. And Nicole, you have to promise me you're going to come back on.
Oh, yeah, I'd love to.
Wonderful. And Robert, do not forget the picture of her with Zorro at 3.
Well, you know, it's an old school photo, you know, back in the day where they still printed them on paper at the Walgreens. So I have to pull it up and scan it in or something. So it might take a little while, but I'll definitely send it over and you can post it on the Five Size page.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, guys. Lots of luck to you, Nicole. Robert, I will be talking to you again soon.
Very good. On behalf of Nicole, my daughter, Nicole Forto, and Dorothy here on the Side By, we'll talk to you guys next time. Goodbye.